Hi everyone, this is Lauren Petrovic, founder of Laurenti New York. Welcome to the Responsible Luxury Podcast. In this special series, we investigate the force of driving responsible consumption and production in the $360 billion luxury goods industry. Over this series, we'll sit down with extraordinary leaders to discuss market dynamics, product strategies, customer experiences, emerging technologies, traceability, and entry into Web3. The pressing need and increasing demand for systemic change to create a more sustainable and responsible industry is a consistent theme. And so in this episode of Responsible Luxury, we confront the distinct uncertainty and disruption facing both the diamond and jewelry industry as a result of the Russian sanctions. As an independent creator, analyst, consultant, and journalist, Avi Kravets brings over 20 years of experience to the table, having previously worked with esteemed organizations such as Rapaport and the Jerusalem Post. Avi recently swapped out his role into something more independent and creatively driven.
Initially, I had this dream to tell the diamond industry story and explain the industry in that sense. But it was essentially a sense of adventure and sort of craving the freedom to create something on my own. When you have ownership, you have freedom to be a little bit more creative than being within the structure of a corporation.
This week on the podcast, I sit down and speak with Avi Kravets to discuss his journey into the diamond and jewelry space and his reflections on sustainability behind the industry. We dive deep and discuss the people and stories behind the industry. Here's Avi Kravets on the Responsible Luxury Podcast. Hello, Avi. Welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Well, thank you, Lauren. It's so great to be here and to see you.
I am so excited for our conversation today and to share your extraordinary journey into the industry with our listeners today and hear some insights.
I look forward to our discussion. There's so much going on in the diamond and jewelry industry. I was thinking, is this unprecedented? But it seems that there's always change and interesting developments going on. And I think that's part of what makes our industry so fascinating, for me anyway.
So I wanted to start by going back to where it all began when you initially started in the industry. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about your personal journey into the space, career-wise, and also from a personal lens as well?
Sure. I kind of feel that I happened upon the diamond industry by chance. I was working as a journalist, and my background within the industry is looking at the industry as from a journalistic point of view, which morphed into more of a research and analysis kind of role more recently. But initially, I was working at a newspaper in Israel, covering the high-tech and tourism industry in Israel, where I'm based, for a daily newspaper. I became a little frustrated with that role, as one does in the grind of newspapers. And so I left the paper. And one of the things that a mentor of mine there said to me was that, you know, journalism is changing in such a fast way with social media and various other factors that have contributed to those changes, and that one really has to find the niches in terms of when you're working at a newspaper, you get exposed to many different broad topics. And so you gain a little knowledge on many different topics. But if one can just differentiate themselves as a, let's say, an expert of some sort in a niche area, then that's a good way to approach one's career path within the journalism space. Anyway, shortly after leaving the newspaper, a friend of mine was working for Rapaport, who I'd worked with at the paper, and heard that I'd left, and there was an opening for a reporter type of position at Rapaport, who I knew nothing about and knew very little about the diamond industry. But I went to the interview and I met with Martin Rapaport, the chairman of the company, and it seemed an interesting interesting opportunity, and I was just kind of happy to have a job, I guess. And so I started there, and I didn't realize at the time that it would really be a great fit for me, both in terms of the eccentricities of the company and of the industry, and maybe being a fit to my personality, and also fitting that goal of finding a niche. And the diamond industry is really a niche within a niche. And so I worked for Rapport for 16 years, and it was a wonderful journey. And I've learned a fortune, both about the way business operates within the diamond industry and also the dynamics of the marketplace. And over the last 6 months, I've embarked on a more independent journey where I am working as an independent creator, analyst, and consultant, and freelance journalist within the diamond space.
A commonality I find between a lot of people is asking the question, how did you fall into the diamond industry? And mostly everyone says, by chance, which is something I find very special. Also, it's just something unexplained, but have reverence towards that.
Well, I will add to that that they're very quickly, and I think it's very common that one develops a love for the industry. You enter by chance and you stay by choice, for sure. And that's certainly my experience.
Enter by chance and stay by choice. I like that. So you were working at Rapport for many years, and you decided to take a leap of faith to start off independently on your own as a journalist, consultant, analyst. You have a wonderful platform to share your voice and share your perspective. What initially triggered that idea, thinking that you wanted to go off and start this on your own?
Yeah, I think a sense of adventure, you know, my and a love of YouTube, frankly. I maybe spend a bit too much time on YouTube and need to spend more time on Netflix. I don't know. But I love the platform, and I love following creators and seeing the creativity that they're able to express on whatever topic through that YouTube channel. And so initially I had this dream to tell the diamond industry story through that YouTube type of longer form than Instagram, say, and TikTok, and explain the industry in that sense. And I'm still embarking on that. It's a bit more nuanced than I initially thought, as often happens in a new venture. But it was essentially a sense of adventure and sort of craving the freedom to be my own, to create something on my own. As much as I loved Rapport, I do love Rapport and have a very good relationship with them, that I feel like I have the agency is a good word. Yeah. to be one's own master of one's own destiny and to express and to be creative in that space. I think when you have your own ownership, you have freedom to be a little bit more creative than being within the structure of a corporation that has its own legacy.
Yes. Always love hearing about an entrepreneur's journey of being led by this curiosity, this inner voice in you, and down this path of creative expression and finding your voice and bringing that unique value and talent and skill set to the industry in a way that no one else can really copy. So for listeners who may not be working in the diamond and jewelry industry, what would you like to share to help them better understand the intricacies and the day-to-day?
Yeah, there's so much there because there's so many misconceptions about the industry, and everyone comes to the diamond product with a certain perspective, ranging from that romantic notion about that the industry sells and markets quite effectively to perhaps more negative perceptions. And so I would answer that question on a number of levels. Firstly, just from an industry structure point of view, I've always been fascinated, and maybe it appeals to my logical side of my personality, that I see a wonderful structure or logic to the way the industry is set up amid the chaos of the industry, because diamond changes hands so many times, and that was always the history of it. But there's also a very clear pipeline from the mine to the manufacturer, to the dealer, to the jewelry wholesaler and manufacturer and designer, to the jewelry retailer. That flow and that almost linear structure appeals to me, but I know that it's not linear because there's so many moving parts. And so there's a certain character to the industry that I think people are not familiar with, and a certain quirkiness within the trade as well. It's one of the things that makes the industry so fun. When you go to a trade show, there's so many different types of personalities and types of businesses, and that's born out of A, the creativity that's required within the product and to make a business out of it. I mean, and that's both from a business point of view and from a design point of view. But also that it attracts a certain character. And I think the more the outsider is exposed to that, the more endearing the industry becomes. That's certainly been my experience. And the second thing that I would highlight for people is the global nature of the diamond industry and the many lives that it touches in many parts of the world, be it in one's local community in the United States or within a mining community in Africa, be it within a more formal mining structure or artisanal mining, to the very vast and wonderful and dynamic manufacturing sector in India, for example. There's so many little stories that need to be told there, and so many lives that it touches, that it's easy to look at the broader tagline type of
the misconceptions and the scrutiny.
But when you meet those people within those communities, it's just very, really does open your eyes to the impact that diamonds have across the globe.
That humanity perspective, and something I wanted to magnify more what you said to build upon, is the perfect balance between business and creativity. The business sense, of course, being the trade and sailing and that chain of custody between all the players in the industry. But then you also have this beautiful creativity and building and designing of these wonderful pieces that can last generations, which that long-term perspective, I think, attracts, again, a certain type of personality and certain type of character, which is something unspoken, and again, something you wouldn't know unless you're in it and feel it.
Yeah. So just to add to that idea, just the combination of nature and human potential is unparalleled, I think. Nature produces this rough diamond, and man takes that to produce a beautiful polished diamond. Yes. And so you need both, and that interaction, and it's a complementing sort of element between what nature has to give and what humankind has to offer is really a romantic and exciting idea for me.
It is, and it's really a beautiful communication between us and the world, the universe, the resources it has to offer. Okay, so I want to talk with you more about public misconceptions about the industry. What have you witnessed regarding ethical considerations and the overall public sentiment of diamonds change over time? If we want to take a capsule of the last 10 years and maybe the last 20 years preceding that.
Well, firstly, within the trade and within the industry, the industry has gone on an awareness journey over the last decade. And so if you look at the messaging that's coming out of the players within the industry, and particularly among the majors in the mining sector and also on the retail side, in between maybe has a bit further to go, but there's far more awareness about social issues, about environmental issues in particular, and sustainability as a way to align with the values of today's consumer. And so it kind of works, you know, in two ways both ways, that consumers are looking for brands that that align with their values. And if they don't know that they are looking for that, the brands are responding by telling them that these are our values, and that's surely what you stand for, you know, in terms of these social issues. And to the industry's credit, it may be a little late to the party. You know, it may have come to this realization a bit later than other industries, but it is there now. It is on that journey. And it's not just about empty sort of marketing messaging. There are some really interesting and impactful projects that many of the leading companies within the diamond and jewelry space are involved in. And that spans many of the mining companies. That's some of the projects that De Beers, for example, is involved in, are quite magnificent. You know, there's a game farm around their mine in South Africa, around Venetia mine, where there is an excess, I stand for correction on which mine it was, but where there was an excess of elephants in the park, which is also not healthy for the ecosystem, I guess. And so they transferred, a thousand elephants to a game park in, I think it was Mozambique, which is sort of neighboring South Africa on the northeastern border. And so that's an enormous undertaking. It was a record-breaking undertaking. In that park in Mozambique, had a deficit of supply of elephants, I guess. But that's just one example. And you see this sort of environmental and community engagements more and more, both on the ground, and it doesn't have to be at that scale. It can be your independent retailer in the United States engaging with their community and whatever their community requires. And you are seeing that more and more. And the big change really is that the brands are using that as a central messaging tool within their public relations. And so when we think about the old days, let's say the 80s and 90s, where companies would write a check on the quiet and give it to a charity and not make a splash about it, today the contribution that corporations are making to sustainability efforts and environmental, social, and etc. Yes. is central to their messaging, and it adds value to their brands. And that's certainly something we're seeing in the diamond and jewelry space today.
Yes. And thinking of the overarching impact of sustainability, it's certainly what I call a suitcase word because it can cover so many things. But thinking of what sustainability truly means is balance between the environment, balance between social impact, and then also balance between economically. And looking at the diamond industry, my thesis is I see it as an engine for not only economic growth, but also social growth, because you visited these producer countries firsthand and have witnessed remarkable social good, the frameworks that these mining sites provide the workers and especially their families. So how do you view sustainability, and what's your guiding definition for sustainability?
Sure. Yeah, I'm trying to stay clear of the corporate jargon, I guess, which is where everyone talks about the three P's. What is it? It's a planet, people and
product
people, man, planet, I don't know. But that is a good guideline. I just want to stay away from the jargon. And so how do I, as I embark on my entrepreneurial journey, I think at the back of my mind, you know, I'm very focused now on creating a revenue stream of some sort, or thinking from a business point of view, how I can monetize my skill set. But then at the back of my mind, I'm thinking, how do these sustainability issues, you know, how do I relate to them, and what is the relationship that I as an entrepreneur would have to those issues? And so I think everyone needs to needs to be thinking about that. You don't have to be You don't have to be an LVMH or a Tiffany to have these issues showcase your values. But I think it is a little more challenging for a smaller personal brand, let's say, or an entrepreneur. And so it's a tough question you ask. It's how do I look at it from an industry point of view? You also got to look at where the consumer is and where the consumer mindset is. And there is certainly a shift towards environmental awareness and social. For some reason, I think more so environmental than the people social thing, which I find interesting or maybe surprising. And maybe it's just a rebalancing of things because we maybe neglected the environmental angle for so long. But certainly, I think one's got to start within your own immediate circle and where you can make a contribution within your community and then sort of go further out. Expanding your circle from there. And seeing, I think that's a good way to approach it or start at least.
And to build on that, you said that you don't have to be an LVMH, a big conglomerate, to be able to tackle these sustainability issues. And sustainability is, I think, a good quality even small businesses can do. And the first way you could start is just having that long-term mindset. Thinking of the next generation is a good way to start thinking about sustainability. How does your business have long-term impact, not only on your local community, but beyond that too, not just day-to-day, but thinking broader, thinking a little bit, yes, linear, but also vertically too, thinking about that awareness, that consciousness for what's around you.
One more point on that is, as a journalist, my role is to make people aware of these issues, and so I am looking for those storylines, and I'm looking for those sort of more people-centric, and particularly people-centric, frankly, when I'm interviewing people for a story. I'm in my reincarnated role, I'm looking more for those human stories of the individual working within the industry than necessarily the CEO of the company. And I think that's where you find more of the impact that the industry is making.
Yes. A topic that is really hot right now, not as slightly controversial, more controversial than slightly, is Russian sanctions.
I thought you were going to say lab grown.
No.
I'm joking.
We'll get there. So starting this year in 2024, there's been phases of sanctioning out these Russian diamonds from the industry. Can you provide a brief overview of these three phases? I know one is happening the 1st of March, and also speak upon some of the traceability systems being used and just how the overall supply chain is going to be affected from mine to market with these sanctions.
Yeah, so the G7 countries got together to implement some sanctions, restrictions on the flow of Russian diamonds. So, you know, Russia is, through the company Alrosa, is the largest volume producer of rough diamonds in the market. It accounts for whatever it is, 25% to 30% of global supply. And since the war in Ukraine broke, and given that Alrosa is a partly government-owned entity, its production and revenue there's a direct line to, say, financing that war effort. And so it's the United States implemented some sanctions soon after the war broke out, albeit not with certain loopholes. The clearest of those being that it banned the direct import of Russian stones, and that Russia is primarily an exporter of rough diamonds. But what happens if Russia supplies a manufacturing center such as India, and those goods are transformed from rough to polished, and then India, and under the initial sanctions, India could theoretically export those goods to the United States. And so it's a question of source versus origin. The goods were sourced in India. Is that it's a different presenting diamond? It's a polished diamond as opposed to, it's an Indian polished diamond as opposed to a Russian rough diamond. Yeah. Yeah. So it's an interesting question that arose for the industry. And so that's where the sanctions in the United States were holding. But as of January 1st, those sanctions of direct imports from Russia were expanded to the G7 countries. And as of March 1st, the restrictions are being extended to goods that were, to use their term, substantially transformed. In other words, those diamonds that have an origin in Russia but have gone on some sort of a journey that they were transformed to a polished diamond in another center and then sent to the United States. So as of March 1st, the sanctions include those polished diamonds. But the challenge is how do you prove those that polished diamond is of Russian origin? And so the G7 countries are exploring ways to account for the diamond throughout that pipeline, and the best way to, or they claim the best way to do so would be to implement some sort of technology that would, traceability technology that would enable companies to verify where the diamond originated through blockchain systems, etc. Mm-hmm. And that's presenting many, many challenges. And so from March 1st, there's a sort of a trial phase that they've spoken about, or what they call a sunrise period, until September 1st, which is the third phase, when the traceability programs would be adopted. But there are many questions as to how this will work. There's talks of all diamonds having to go through Antwerp to be registered certified onto this blockchain and certified as, say, G7 compliant. But that in itself brings a whole bunch of challenges and questions for the industry. If you consider, just as one example, an auction house who auctions rough diamonds, and they're based in, let's say, Johannesburg, and they're sourcing their diamonds from various small mines throughout South Africa and mixing them to present a product offering that gives presents some sort of added value because of their assortments. Do they need to send all their goods to Antwerp and then back again to Johannesburg before they mix those goods and aggregate them into the auction? And so it's presenting so many questions and challenges that I'm not sure your bureaucrats within the G7 government, kind of not trade necessarily, government right. Led initiatives and committees have thought through. And so they're running into these issues. But the overall idea is to be able to account for your diamonds throughout the pipeline. I'm sort of adopting the view that if you're a business within the G7 countries, and particularly, let's say you're a retailer in the United States, you've got to know your supplier and your supplier's supplier and get those assurances of where the diamond comes from, and let the technocrats do their thing, but you just do what you can that makes sense to ensure that that you have that accountability of your diamonds.
I think it's going to be very challenging to be able to certify all of these and get these on chain, on ledger, these rough to polished diamonds. However, in terms of opportunity, I think there is an incredible opportunity here. Thinking beyond the borders, right? Once these diamonds enter G7 borders, the opportunity that retailers and consumers have to see this incredibly rich data story of their diamonds. And there's a large segment of customers who may not necessarily care. However, I think what's really exciting to me is to see the entire chain of custody from, if I source diamonds for a custom design for someone, me being able to see the date of polishing, the location of when the diamond was cut and polished, the mine it was sourced from. And also too, if there's an opportunity to be able to tie into that human perspective too, to connect with maybe the miners who mine those stones. I don't think necessarily the governments and the bureaucrats are thinking in that perspective, but I think that this is a multi-stakeholder issue. I don't think it's just upstream. I think that everyone really needs to be intellectually engaged. The government should listen to all perspectives, you know, from small businesses to these large corporations, and, you know, unsure of what that's going to look like the next couple of months. But how do you see this playing out for the midstream market and these independent brands, designers, and small businesses?
Yeah, I mean, what you mentioned is spot on. Because before the sanctions issue came about, the use of technology and chain technology and this ability to trace your diamond was being driven by the brands. You know, the brands wanted to, not at all, I think, because consumers were coming into their stores and asking, where's this diamond from? You know, there's that kind of perception out there. Consumers don't do that. I don't do that as a consumer.
Right.
But the brands were using or started to use that ability to account for their diamond within their storytelling. And you know, and that's what you're alluding to, is that it can be a very powerful storytelling mechanism. That if a consumer, you know, can kind of picture a woman getting engaged and receiving that diamond ring and showing it to her friends and you know, size matters and sparkle matters and all the four C's. But if she knows that this diamond came from Botswana and can show, maybe through an app or whatever it is, how diamonds affect the everyday person in Botswana, that would be a bragging point in my book. You know,
yes.
That's, you know, very few people know that in Botswana there's free education through university level, there's free healthcare, and that's all on the back of the diamond industry. And so, and that's just one example. Botswana's the poster child, but I think that there is that opportunity that might be lost as we get into the nitty gritty of having to adhere to whatever rules and regulations that the G7 implements. The challenge for us as an industry is to overcome that and use it as an opportunity to tell a very cool and powerful story.
To that point, it's going to be a major effort to bring that full-scale traceability into the market. The requirement now is just for the traceability to reach the borders. Do you see an opportunity for increased traceability once these polished diamonds get to market, like, and distributed to these wholesalers and retailers? Or do you see it just stopping there?
Well, firstly, in terms of just from a legal point of view, whoever's bringing in those diamonds to the United States are going to have to vouch for them at customs. But I think once it's on at that level and let's say it's on that blockchain and you have that traceability element, it shouldn't stop there, because that's where it becomes powerful as a selling tool and sort of transcending the legal requirements. That's where you can become creative and use it as a way to enhance your personal brand, whatever it is. You asked about the midstream earlier. And the midstream will play a role in that storytelling, because they can show the cutter, in the individual cutter in Surat who was involved in producing that diamond, and they have a human story to tell. And so you do see among the bigger, more sort of tech savvy diamond manufacturers that have developed sort of apps that retailers can buy into to tell that story. And it begins at the mining phase and goes through their factory in India.
Thinking in terms of sustainability as well, especially the UK right now is buckling down on digital product passports, DPPs, which I think America's is not as invested in it, mostly speaking from a regulation standpoint. But do you see this being an opportunity to shaping this into similar to that digital product passport story that the EU is starting to require for brands and retailers to sell products, essentially for retailers to explain how their products are made, where their products were sourced? But to me, this rhymes what's happening right now with our industry and the diamond jewelry industry.
Yeah. I mean, maybe the grading labs can play a role in that. I know that the GIA has had initiatives to include source of origin on their reports. They've had a separate source of proof of origin reports that they've introduced in the past. I can't remember if they're still doing that. But certainly that can play a role, that if you have this full traceability that's technologically driven, there's no reason why your grading report can't have that on as an added element. And who knows, maybe it would be a value determiner as well. It might be interesting along the line to, you know, in 20 years time, if a Botswana origin diamond sells at a premium to another diamond, and that's actually a question that's coming out now, because theoretically you've got Alrosa, the Russian mining company, whose production accounts for, we said, 25-30% of the market, and they do have markets to sell to. You know, there are non-G7 nations that are in which it is perfectly legal to import those diamonds. And in particular, you know, China's a huge market. India's a big market, consumer market as well. And so those Alrosa diamonds are available and they are being sold. And so it'll be interesting to see if there are different sort of, if the diamond trade sort of bifurcates between those, between some sort of premium product or not. And that initially became a branding play. You know, so, okay, they may not sell within the wholesale market at a premium, but the brand is adding value through that storytelling. And so they are using that element to add value to their offering. So there isn't much evidence to suggest that at wholesale that has had an impact, but you never know, it might at some point.
For listeners who come from the retail space, how do you see them playing out this narrative if we talk about origin story? What recommendations would you give to them on how to be able to tell a lot of this, again, with the sanctions and everything? It's very technical, but how can they spin this to be able to tell an interesting narrative to their consumers, if you have any ideas?
I think the key would be to connect on a human level, both with one's consumer and also with one's supplier. That supplier and the chain of custody has a human narrative, which inevitably most should, focusing on that in their storytelling. You know, consumers, I think, come into the jewelry store with the value in mind, and that they have price in mind, but they also come in with emotion. And the challenge and creativity of the jewelry retailer is to connect on both of those levels. And I think that the human story behind the diamond can feed into both. It adds value to the stone, and it certainly adds emotion to the purchase and brings meaning to the purchase.
Over the next couple of months, I think it's going to be really evident, especially with the steep decline in pricing with lab-growns, how they're going to find its place in the market, because lab-growns can't tell this story, this impact, like the natural diamond industry can. Can you give your two cents on lab-growns versus natural diamonds?
I think what I'm seeing in the lab-grown space is that the industry, the lab-grown industry is at a, I don't want to say crossroads, it's a little cliched, but it's at a point where, as you say, it's kind of finding its place in the market. It's maturing, let's say, because it's gone through this growth spurt. And it's at a point now where there's greater consumer awareness of the product. And there's also some sort of acceptance within the trade that it's here to stay. You know, I don't feel that it's as controversial as it used to be for anyone in the industry to deal in lab grown. But I think what is also happening is that it's consolidating at various levels. And what I think at a retail level, that you are starting to see some big brand plays that are sort of becoming the major sellers of lab grown, and I think like a Pandora's their lab grown diamond offering is still a very small part of their greater revenue. It's certainly growing, and they are investing in that narrative, and they're investing in it, and so I think that we're going to see more of those sort of more commercial sort of lower price brands in which the lab-grown product fits nicely. Right. And typically a retailer would sell it as an independent retailer, let's say, would sell it as a generic product. And I'm just wondering if that's going to be as effective as, I think the retailer is going to start to see its margins come down, and also come to the realization that they can't rely on lab-grown. They may be able to rely on lab-grown for margin, but they can't rely on the product to drive their top-line revenue within the store. You know, they need the natural diamond price and value to, you know, those bigger ticket items to drive revenue. And so what I think is going to happen within the lab grown space is that you're going to see more sort of semi branding of lab grown, that they'll be able to sell, to add a bit of value maybe to the lab grown offering, than if it has some sort of story behind it. And you're right, they can't tell the same story as the natural diamond industry, but they have a narrative that they can, you know, there are certainly storylines that they can milk.
So time has definitely flown by, and as we come to a close, if you could visually depict the ideal state for the industry for all to see, what would it say and what would it convey? Think of a big billboard in the middle of Times Square. What would you market out to for the public to know about the industry?
That's a tough question. I always tell my friends that I've drunk the industry Kool-Aid, you know, so I tend to throw out all the cliches and advocate for the industry. But I, you know, we started our conversation saying that I happened upon the industry by chance, but I've come to really appreciate the beauty of the product. And I think that beauty is driven by its physical beauty, but also it's the people that make up the industry. It's one of the areas that keeps me in the industry. I just love interacting with people within the space. So it's not much of a catchy slogan for a billboard on Times Square, but for a shameless plug on my website, I kind of look at diamonds, people, and stories as the three sort of pillars that I think the industry is built on. And each one has potential beauty that is unparalleled, and that's what I want people to recognize.
That is beautiful, and couldn't leave off on a better note. Avi, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for your incredible wisdom and insights. Where can listeners follow you to find you, connect with you, and support the work that you're doing?
Sure. Thank you for, firstly, thank you for the discussion. It's been a pleasure. And I love the initiative and the opportunity to connect with people. And they can find me on my website, avikravitz.com. So it's AviKravitz.com. And they can find me by searching my name on LinkedIn. I think I'm, you know, with all the, I'm active, very active on LinkedIn. And I have a presence on Instagram as well under the same name. And I'm trying to build my Instagram presence, but I think my personality is more suited to LinkedIn. I do enjoy that platform. So those are kind of the options, I think.
For anyone listening, I'll drop down his links in the show notes below this episode. Avi, best of luck to you, and I hope to see you soon.
Thank you so much, Lauren. Appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
If you enjoyed today's episode, you can catch more Responsible Luxury Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and the Laurenti New York Media page. If you have any questions you want answered or ideas to share, please reach out to us at concierge@laurentinewyork, and I link that down in the show notes below, or you can connect with me directly on LinkedIn, Instagram, and X. Let us come together to transform the future of responsible luxury. See you next week.